Now it's time to talk about the particulars at the molecular level of DNA replication. And we see two schematics here, A and B, representing the dichotomy of cell types. It happens a little bit differently in a prokaryotic cell versus a eukaryotic cell. And that's basically because of differences in chromosomes. We've talked about other differences between prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells. But when it comes to chromosomes, the difference is that a prokaryotic cell generally has a single chromosome, and it is a circular chromosome, a so-called circular chromosome. It's not always shaped like a circle, but it just means it's a loop. It doesn't have any ends. It comes back onto itself. Whereas a eukaryotic cell has some number of chromosomes, usually, if not always, greater than one. It depends on the species, though. And whatever number of chromosomes that eukaryotic cell has, those chromosomes are linear, which means they do have ends. They have two ends. They don't wrap around on themselves. Other than that, really the basics are the same. And so let's look at how this DNA replication happens first, since it's at the top of the slide, in prokaryotic cells. And remember the color scheme I was talking about last time that this book uses. Dark blue means the original DNA that's already there. Light blue means the new DNA that's being added as part of replication. So we're starting with a single double-stranded circular DNA. The proteins are, just the DNA of the chromosome. And for simplicity, the twists of the helix are not shown here. But even though it's a circular chromosome, a circular DNA, it does have twists. It's still double helical. And it would just make it a nightmare to look at if they actually showed you the twists. But they're there. Notice, though, that both strands here are dark blue. This is the original DNA before replication occurs. And even though a circle doesn't have any beginning or end, DNA replication happens or starts at a particular place along that circle, represented by the pair of black dots here. It's just part of the overall sequence of nucleotides. But it's recognizable by the cell, and since that's where replication begins, that place, wherever it is called the origin of replication. All right, so remember I told you that for DNA to do either of its jobs, whether it's replication, which we're looking at here, or transcription, which we'll look at in the next chapter, you have to be able to read the code to do either of those things, and therefore you have to get in there and look at those nucleotides at a molecular level, which means the two strands of DNA need to be separated from each other in order to read that code. So the beginning of DNA replication requires separation of the two strands, and that happens at the origin of replication. You can see that two dark blue strands are being separated. And when that occurs, a football-shaped structure is formed. I mean, there's nothing added here. It's just the shape of the strands after they're partially separated from each other. This football shape with two points is called a replication bubble. And one replication bubble has two replication forks. The replication forks are simply the points of the football shape. Well, notice also that once the bubble is formed and the strands are separated from each other so each one can be read, then the rules of complementarity can be used. In other words, the cell knows what particular sequence of new nucleotides to add because it just adds them in the complementary sequence compared to the dark blue that it's reading. So that's the light blue material that's being added. And the replication forks get unzipped farther and farther, making the bubble bigger and bigger, until eventually you get all the way to the other side of the circle. And when that happens, the process is complete. And notice what you have are two double-stranded DNAs, circular DNAs. Each one is semi-conservative. Each one has one original strand, dark blue, and one new strand. And also, each of these two double-stranded DNAs is identical to each other, to the other, and they're both identical to the original one, which is exactly what you need in order for a cell to prepare to split into two, because when it splits into two, it needs to give each daughter cell the entire DNA that it had originally. Well, now there are two identical copies, so those both of those cells are going to be able to live. And the photomicrograph here just shows you that these replication bubbles really do exist. This is a photograph. This is a cartoon. Well, largely the same thing happens in a eukaryotic cell, except, of course, there are multiple chromosomes, and they are each independently and simultaneously being replicated. Here we're just looking at one of the chromosomes, and it is linear, so there are two ends to it. It's much longer than it looks. That's why it's fading out. So it's some length. But unlike a prokaryotic chromosome that has a single origin of replication, a eukaryotic chromosome has multiple origins of replication spaced more or less regularly along the length of that linear chromosome. Now, this wouldn't have to be the case. You could have a long linear chromosome and a single origin of replication in the middle, and you could open it up and it would get bigger and bigger, and the replication forks would move toward the ends until eventually you open up all the way and you'd be done, right? So it could happen with just one origin of replication. But it's much more efficient to have multiple ones that get opened simultaneously. Because if you do that, each replication bubble only has to grow until it reaches the next replication bubble. And since they're all simultaneously growing, you can get the whole job done a lot quicker if you do it with many simultaneously replicated bubbles. And that is important for a eukaryotic cell because in addition to having linear versus circular chromosomes, a difference is that a typical eukaryotic chromosome is much longer in terms of sequence than a prokaryotic chromosome is. So it takes longer. But the result is the same. You end up with two double-stranded DNAs, semi-conservative, half old, half new, and each one is identical to the original one. Well, that wasn't actually the molecular detail, but now we can start thinking about the molecular detail, starting with 13. There are several different proteins important in this process, each doing a particular job. And all of the proteins that I'm going to mention, except one, are not only proteins, but they're enzymes. They're acting as enzymes. And that, in a lot of cases, that's obvious from their names. The dark blue DNA here, both of these are dark blue. This is the original stuff. No replication has occurred yet. But we're already slightly into the process. This isn't the very beginning. Some things have already happened. Because what we see here is half of a bubble already opened up. I say half because if we continued this off screen to the right, you'd have another replication fork right here and there would be one bubble. Okay, but obviously that bubble had to open up originally, and so there was an origin of replication somewhere in the middle of the bubble before the bubble formed. And so the first of the proteins in this process to act is the one shown in green here. Actually, a pair of these. These green ones are called helicase. Obviously an enzyme based on the name, and it gets its name because it's named after the helical structure of DNA. But its job is to recognize the origin of replication, separate the two strands to form the bubble, And then one of those two helicases will start unzipping in one direction. That's this one that we're seeing unzipping it toward the left at the fork. And then the other helicase is busy unzipping it to the right, off the screen to the right. And the reason that its job is nice and easy is because of something I mentioned last time. What's holding the two strands together are hydrogen bonds between complementary nucleotides on opposite strands, and therefore it's easy to break. But the reason, as I said, to separate the two strands is so that the cell can read the sequence on each single strand. And if helicase, as you see in this figure, is moving along, unzipping farther and farther, then where it first separated the two strands, once it gets out of the way, those two strands would just go right back together, right? They would, because they're still complementary to each other, and the whole reason that they're hydrogen bonded to begin with is because they are complementary to each other. So without helicase there anymore, these two things would go right back together and you wouldn't be able to read the code again, or you wouldn't be able to start reading the code. So this brings up the job of these gray proteins, and these are the ones that are not enzymes. These are called single-strand binding proteins. And they follow helicase as it unzips. They're behind helicase, and they really just keep the DNA strands from going back together. Keep them apart long enough for the next protein to come along and start reading the code. And that next protein's job, the next protein to act is the pink one, which is called primase, as you see. Now, it's called this because its job is to lay down what is called the primer. The primer is a short sequence of nucleotides, but they are the first nucleotides laid down. And notice that the primer is an RNA primer, meaning it's made out of RNA nucleotides. Well, if you think about the goal of this whole process, the goal is to produce brand new DNA polynucleotides, DNA strands, made out of nothing but DNA nucleotides. Well, an RNA primer is not DNA. It's made out of RNA nucleotides. It has the wrong sugar, right? It has ribose instead of deoxyribose. So, why would you do this? Well, the answer is you wouldn't do it if you could get away with not doing it. But actually, in a cell, it will not be possible to lay down DNA nucleotides as the first nucleotides. In other words, a cell can't put DNA nucleotides down onto nothing. The only thing a cell can add DNA to, DNA nucleotides, is to an existing sequence, and it can make it longer by adding DNA nucleotides to that strand that's already there. But RNA can be laid down onto nothing. And that's why the cell is doing it, because there's no other way. It's going to be a problem, though, that needs to be dealt with, because the final product can't have any RNA in it. Okay, so primase lays down the primer. And keep in mind the polarity of any individual strand. And it can be a strand of any length, including just a single nucleotide. However long the strand is, there is a 3' end and a 5' end, remember. Okay? Well, I'm mentioning this again because it brings up an important point about making this strand longer and longer, which is what needs to be done here. There are two ends to this RNA primer, a 3' end and a 5' end. But the cell is only ever able to add nucleotides to the 3' end of a strand, never the 5' end. So the 5' end is there, and you do need DNA here, But you can only add it to the 3' end. That's why that arrow is in the direction it is. Now, the we'll talk about other proteins when we get to them in the pictures, but the one that we haven't talked about in this picture is the blue one called topoisomerase. And it has an important function that I'm going to hopefully make you appreciate by thinking of a rope instead of a DNA. A DNA is a double helix, right? There's two strands, kind of like a braid with two strands. Most braids have more than two, but you can think of a rope with just two strands, right? Twisted. And if you had such a rope and it was connected to the wall on one end and you're at the other end, you could pretty easily separate the two strands just by pulling them apart, right? It would be easy at first, but the more you do that, the more the rope between you and the wall gets tighter and more tightly and tightly twisted. And it would be harder and harder to separate those two strands. You see that? The same is true for DNA for the same reason. So even though the double helical shape is not shown here, it's part of the DNA, and the more you unzip it, the more tightly wound it gets upstream of where you're zipping. Therefore, you need topoisomerase to be ahead of helicase, another one at the other end, to every now and then cut the DNA, let it flop around to relieve the tension, and then sew it back together so that you can continue to unzip it, basically. Okay, 14. In this picture, we've already added some DNA, so we're looking ahead in the process. But notice what we have here. The dark blue is the original DNA, and it's 3' at the top, 5' at the bottom. The new strand has to be anti-parallel to that. So the new strand in light blue is 5' end up here, 3' end on the bottom. Remember that the 3' end is the only end that you can add to. So it's growing downward in this picture. Well, the protein that is an enzyme also that has the job of reading the code, reading the nucleotide in the original dark blue strand, and then figuring out what kind of nucleotide needs to be added complementary to that in the new strand, that is called DNA polymerase. As you see in the orange box, notice that it's an enzyme, so it's listed above the arrow, not to either side of it. But DNA polymerase is not a single enzyme, actually. It's a family. There are multiple versions. And even though this book doesn't list it, the specific version of DNA polymerase acting for this purpose is DNA polymerase 3, Roman numeral 3. Well, what's happening here is that DNA polymerase 3 is reading the next nucleotide to come up in the sequence, which is this adenine, right? And by the rules of strict complementarity, that's going to call for a thymine-containing nucleotide. That's why the T is coming in here. Each nucleotide in a polynucleotide, in a strand, is more specifically a nucleoside monophosphate. I say more specifically because the term nucleotide doesn't tell you how many phosphates there are. To be a nucleotide, you have to have a nitrogenous base, a sugar, and at least one phosphate, but it could be more. That's why the more descriptive term is nucleoside monophosphate. This is the nucleoside, the sugar and the nitrogenous base, and one phosphate makes it a monophosphate. That's what has to be in the final product, a nucleoside monophosphate. But notice, a nucleoside monophosphate is not what's coming in. Instead, it's a nucleoside triphosphate. There's three phosphates hooked to it, not just one. So why would the cell do it this way? Why not bring in what's needed, a nucleoside monophosphate? Why bring it in as a nucleoside triphosphate? Do you have any guesses? Well, we've talked about nucleoside triphosphates before, but we paid attention to one specifically more than any other. What is the most famous nucleoside triphosphate that we've spent quite a bit of time talking about in this course? ATP. Adenosine is a nucleoside. It's adenine and ribose. And if you add three phosphates to that, you have adenosine triphosphate. That's a nucleoside triphosphate with adenine as its nitrogenous base. And what is the claim to fame for ATP?
It's the main form of energy used in our body.
Right. It's short-term energy storage that can then be released. The energy can be released to drive endergonic processes, right? Well, we're building a polynucleotide, one nucleotide at a time. We're making it bigger and bigger, more and more complex. So in terms of metabolism, what word would you describe? What would you, word would you use to describe that process? Metabolically speaking.
Metabolism?
Well, what part of metabolism? What half of metabolism? Anabolism. This is an anabolic process, building bigger and bigger things. And therefore, energetically, what word does that correspond to? Endergonic. This is never going to happen for free. You have to force this to happen, right? It's an expensive process to build DNA. And that's why you're bringing this in as a nucleoside triphosphate. By cleaving off two of the phosphates, that releases the energy necessary to hook it on and make a more complex molecule. Okay? And so that's what DNA polymerase 3 catalyzes. The cleaving of two phosphates off of a nucleoside triphosphate to leave a nucleoside monophosphate that gets hooked to the existing chain at the 3' end. And I don't know whether I mentioned it before, but in the sugar phosphate backbone, which is what's holding the strand together, the bonds between the phosphate and the sugar is called a phosphodiester bond. And so that's what needs to be formed, and that's what the energy released from cleaving off these two phosphates goes into. Now, usually in the case of ATP, for instance, that we've talked about, we usually just cleave off one phosphate. Right here, we're cleaving off two. And when you have two inorganic phosphates that are still hooked together, they're inorganic because they're no longer associated with a carbon skeleton. But when they're hooked together, they're called together pyrophosphate. But pyrophosphate does not last very long because it will soon split into two individual inorganic phosphates and just become part of the phosphate pool that's always there in the cell. So the next moment it might be stuck on to an ADP to make ATP. For instance. But that's the whole idea of DNA polymerase 3's job, and then it's just goes to the next dark blue nucleotide in sequence, reads that it's a C, and therefore you have to bring in a nucleoside triphosphate that involves a G, a guanosine triphosphate is what it would be called. Okay. 15. Well, notice in the top we see a complete replication bubble. It has two replication forks, and they are being unzipped in opposite directions. And all kinds of new DNA is being added here, all the light blue. You're going to eventually end up with two brand new strands, two complete light blue strands. But they're not built in one piece. It requires multiple pieces. And there are actually two categories of new strands being formed here. They'll be indistinguishable, but during the process of being built, we distinguish them into two categories. the so-called leading strands, and there's one leading strand here, and then diagonally in the bubble there's another leading strand. Plus there are lagging strands, the other category. And notice that the lagging strands are built out of shorter pieces and more of them. Well, lagging means falling behind. And the lagging strands are called this because it takes a little longer to build them. But why does it take longer to build them is something that is hopefully explainable with the picture below it. Actually, what we're looking at here is the leading strand, so let me talk about it first. The leading strand is the lucky one, so to speak, because it is being built in the same direction that the fork is being unzipped. Okay? So notice this top strand of DNA, the original DNA, it is 5 prime on the left. And therefore, the new strand, which has to be anti-parallel to that, is going to be 3 prime on the left, which is the only direction you can add to, right? You can only add to the 3 prime end. But the fork is being opened up toward the left, and the strand is growing toward the left, so everything is in perfect position. All you have to do is lay down one primer and then keep adding DNA nucleotides using DNA polymerase 3's help to that 3 prime end, making it longer and longer, and it will unzip in the direction that it's growing. That's the leading strand. And the same thing is happening on the other strand, but in the opposite direction, because the other fork is opening up in the other direction. So that's what's pictured on the bottom, the leading strand being built. It requires only one primer. 16 is just a detail of that top of the previous figure. But now let's focus on these shorter fragments that make up the lagging strand. Each lagging strand is not just one fragment, but multiple fragments that need to be built one after another. And each of these little fragments that is just part of one lagging strand is called an Okazaki fragment. It's just named after a Japanese biologist. Here's the problem. Just like any strand that's growing, it can only grow in the 3 prime direction, right? But the 3 prime direction on this strand is to the right, and the fork is opening up to the left. So what has to happen is that the fork has to open up enough to expose some DNA, and let's say the fork was here right by the numeral 1. Once there's enough room, then you can lay down a primer and grow it toward the right. Then you open up the fork a little bit more until you have room for another primer. And then you can add on that until you run into the previous primer, and so on. So the lagging strand is made up piecewise as several individual Okazaki fragments. Similarly, on the diagonal, there's another lagging strand, just everything's in the reverse direction. All right, so if you imagine this process occurring, well, let me go to the next slide, 17. You can see these Okazaki fragments being built, but if you imagine all of what I've described so far happening until the point at which there's no empty space anymore, in other words, all of the nucleotides have been added, the process is not complete at that point for a few reasons. One reason, of course, is that even though you've added as many nucleotides as there was space, not all of those nucleotides are DNA, and they have to all be DNA. So you have to deal with those red primers, one for each leading strand and several for each lagging strand, one for each Okazaki fragment. All right? Well, DNA polymerase 3 adds the DNA nucleotides, and that's its job is done at that point. So it takes another specialized enzyme to deal with the primers. And That's the one that is yellow in this picture. It's another version of DNA polymerase, but it's DNA polymerase 1. DNA polymerase 1 goes along the new strands and looks for RNA primers. And one nucleotide at a time, DNA polymerase 1 will remove the RNA nucleotide, but replace it with a DNA nucleotide of the right type. So it not only removes the RNA, it also reads the DNA on the strand where the hole it just made is to see what the proper DNA version of nucleotide it has to replace it with using complementarity rules. It's able to do that for all the nucleotides, but the job is still not done because DNA polymerase 1 is not able to sew together this piece of DNA with the next piece of DNA. So all the holes are full, and it's pure DNA at this point, but it's still in several different fragments that need to all be sewn together end to end. In other words, DNA polymerase 1 is not able to make this final phosphodiester bond to make it all one continuous strand. And that requires yet another specialized protein. That's the teal colored one down here. And that is called DNA ligase. This is an enzyme named for the fact that it ligates or ties together something. Same root as in the word ligand, which is something that is bound to or tied to something. Or in ligature. A ligature is a surgical tying. DNA ligase is able to make that phosphodiester bond between two adjacent existing DNA sequences. And so by the time its job is done, then DNA replication is complete, assuming that it's done everywhere along the entire length of the chromosome. That's summarized in 18. So we've already gone through the information. This is really just a summary. What happens first, remember, is that helicase, or really a pair of helicase enzymes, recognize the origin of replication before there's any separation of the strands, separates the two strands to form the replication bubble. And then each helicase will move in opposite directions along one strand or the other to unzip the forks farther and farther. The single-strand binding proteins follow behind to keep the two separated strands separated long enough so that primase, the pink ones, come along and lay down the first nucleotides, which have to be RNA nucleotides, and that's why they're called RNA primers. Those are the red things. Then DNA polymerase 3 in orange can add DNA nucleotides one at a time to the 3' end of each primer. That fills up all the space, but now you have to deal with the primers. And so DNA polymerase 1 comes along, recognizes all the RNAs, removes them and replaces them with the appropriate DNA nucleotides. And then finally DNA ligase comes along and makes all the phosphodiester bonds so that it's all one complete brand new DNA, fully DNA strand. And the only one not pictured here is topoisomerase off the screen to the left here, taking out the tension every now and then. Okay, 19. So we're done with DNA replication, and it is remarkable how well DNA replication happens. What I mean is that it has an impressively low error rate, especially if you can compare it to like an industrial something that's done over and over in a factory. You know, a single DNA is millions of nucleotides. So if you compare that to doing something in a factory millions of times, there's going to be many, many errors in that factory, right? Well, there are occasional errors that are made in DNA replication. Impressively low, but it's still a positive number of errors. Also, though, damage can occur to DNA after it's properly made. Even if there's no error, DNA can suffer damage, like in this picture. What we see here are two adjacent nucleotides within the same sequence. And remember, they are not supposed to be interacting with each other. They're just hanging off of the backbone. But especially in response to ultraviolet light, which is one reason why sunlight can give you skin cancer, the UV can cause two adjacent thymines, two T's, to form a covalent bond between them, which shouldn't be there. That's called a thymine-thymine dimer. And it happens fairly easily. But there's other things that can go wrong as well. The point here is that cells have the ability to recognize that errors have been made. And they're able to do something about it, to correct those errors. We call this the proofreading system of the cell. All right, so here you have a defective region of one DNA strand. And part of the proofreading mechanism in this example is the use of nucleases. Nuclease is an enzyme, but it's not a single enzyme, it's a family. There's many different nucleases. But nucleases are enzymes that are able to cleave phosphodiester bonds. In other words, cut out a little section of DNA, namely the defective part. See, if this is the defect. You make a cut on either end of that defect so you can get rid of that section. And, of course, the cell doesn't have to be afraid to throw that away, right? Because it has the other strand still intact, which will tell it what these DNA nucleotides that it's removing have to be when it adds in fresh ones. And so nucleases undergo what is called excision. Size means cut and X means out. So excision just means excise is the verb. Excision, though, well, that's just one S, is to cut out. Excision repair involves nucleases doing the excising, and then DNA polymerase 1, just like it operates in normal DNA replication, can come along and add the new ones to replace them. But just like in DNA replication, DNA polymerase 1 can't make that final phosphodiester bond, so you also need DNA ligase to come along and complete the process. But once that's done, it's just as though this damage or defect had never occurred. This is completely cured DNA. Now, 20 is a special problem that only eukaryotes have. Prokaryotes don't have the problem I'm going to talk about because their DNAs are circular. They don't have any ends. Okay, the ends of linear chromosomes that eukaryotic cells have are called telomeres. Remember we talked about the centromere, which is where two sister chromatids are connected together? Well, telomeres get their name because telo means far, like a telescope. So they are the very ends, the telomeres. And the telomeres pose a problem in eukaryotes. This has to do with the fact that you can only add nucleotides to the 3' end. And you can't lay down DNA onto nothing. So let's look at this original strand in dark blue. This is just one of two strands, but we're looking at the 3' end. The same thing would be happening on the other strand at the other end, though, because its 3' end is over here. So this problem occurs at both ends, but on one strand each. So this is the 3' end of the original material. This new strand has the 5' end next to it, of course. Well, this RNA primer was laid down here, no problem, because you can put RNA down onto nothing. So no problem putting the primer down. this primer is a little bit different from this primer. Because when DNA polymerase 1 comes along, and its job is to remove the primers, when it removes this second primer on the right,
it can replace these RNA nucleotides with DNA nucleotides because this piece of DNA already exists, and it just adds to that.
But when DNA polymerase removes this RNA primer, there isn't no DNA to the left of it, because that's off the end. And therefore, all it can do is remove it and leave it empty. In other words, this new strand is shorter than the original strand. And it will get shorter and shorter each cell cycle, each generation. Each time DNA replication occurs, the new strand, the new material, will be a little shorter than the old. Now, obviously, that is a big problem, right? Now, DNA is an enormously long double strand. Each strand is an enormously long molecule in its own right. It's one polynucleotide. Millions of C's, T's, A's, and G's in some sequence. Genes, which we haven't really studied closely yet, are also sequences of DNA, but genes are just a subset of the overall sequence. So each gene begins somewhere and ends somewhere within the overall very long sequence. And I usually use the film analogy, even though nowadays most movies are digital. But you're still familiar with film, right? Projected film with frames. Well, if you are projecting a film, a true film requires a projection camera, right? And you need to load it with the film. The very end of the film reel is not part of the movie. It's a leader. Because it takes some distance that you have to reel through the machine to get it into the take-up reel before the first actual frame of the movie gets to the light. And if you have a very popular movie, the projectionist is stringing this through many times and it gets frayed. So they have a long leader so that there's plenty of room in case you have to clip it off to make it a nice fresh end. No problem. Now, if you kept doing that and kept getting it shorter and shorter, eventually you'd be taking out the very first part of the movie, which would be, in the analogy of a cell, that means you would be finally going into the genes. The DNA is the whole sequence. Most of that is not genes. The genes are just little pieces of that sequence with a bunch of DNA in between that's not genes. And that there's a bunch of DNA at the ends. So it's not an immediate problem that the new strand is shorter because this is not yet part of a gene. But if you make it shorter every time a cell goes through a cell cycle, eventually you'll be cutting into a gene, and that eventually will mean that the cell can't live, which would mean we eukaryotes couldn't exist. We would be extinct because of this problem. So obviously there is a way that cells have evolved a solution to this problem. And the solution is to use a special enzyme that is found in eukaryotes called telomerase, named for the telomeres, which is where the problem's occurring at the ends. And telomerase is a special enzyme that fills this with just a dummy sequence. It makes fresh leader, in other words. And then it can be eaten away for several rounds, and then you add more. This is what keeps us alive. Prokaryotes don't have to deal with that because they don't have any telomeres. The final two pictures of this, or slides in this show, are really just one picture in the textbook it came from. 21 and 22, notice, are just one wide picture. But it's a special picture because as you go from left to right in the picture, including the next slide as well, you're getting closer and closer in. You're zooming in. So at the left edge, we're zoomed out. And what you see here is the double helix of DNA. And what you have to appreciate is how well it is packed into cells. Because I think you did a calculation in the last lab, didn't you, about how long DNA is? It's, for a human, it's roughly a meter long. That's in one cell. A meter of DNA needs to fit into not only an invisible cell, tiny invisible cell, but in the much smaller nucleus within that cell. And so there has to be a way to get that enormously long thing into a compact form with, and still be able to use it. Well, what we're looking at here is how DNA is complexed together with the proteins. What is the overall mixture called? Chromatin, exactly. So the blue is the DNA. The purple sperm-looking things are proteins. And they are the protein component of chromatin. The proteins are individually called histones, or histone proteins. Each one has this sperm appearance because it has a globular head and a tail. But it's nothing to do with sperm. Now, if you take 8 of these histones, all identical to each other, and you arrange them like you see right here, a pair of four, four on one side, four on the other, with the tails radially sticking out, then you form what is functionally the same thing as a hose reel, just like a garden hose reel. And therefore, some of the overall length of the DNA can be wound around this complex of 8 histones. Okay? Well, that overall combination of 8 histones plus however much DNA is wound around that reel is called a nucleosome. And there are many, many nucleosomes along the length. Each one is taking up part of the DNA length. That's what gives it a beads on a string appearance, as you see in the photomicrograph. Each bead here is a nucleosome. And the string between them is the DNA that's not wound around anything at that point. Well, that drastically decreases the overall length, right? It makes it much more compact just for that reason alone. But then as we get closer and closer in, what we see happening is that these thousands of individual nucleosomes get grouped together, making a very much thicker, wider strand. That's at the right edge, and that makes it much more compact as well. But now let's continue to the right as we go to 22. That already compact wide strand is then looped back and forth many, many times to form a much wider piece, which is what we see making up the stuff of a chromosome on the right edge. So that enormously long DNA is all in there, wound around many, many nucleosomes, and then looped back and forth many times. And what I was saying when we started the chapter, it might have been the last chapter, is that this material is there the whole time, the chromatin is, but until it actually clumps up into this and we see it as an individual piece, we don't use the word chromosome. Chromosome just refers to it in this form, but it's the same material. Okay, that is that chapter.